The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week, and are we proud, is Jesse McKinley, the Albany Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Welcome back, Jesse. What a pleasure that you show up and honor us with your presence.
Happy holidays.
Okay, so let's talk about some potential topics for the year in review. Okay,
yeah.
One, GOP senators flood the exits in New York, meaning they're leaving, they're quitting, they're going. And party woes deepen in the last 2 weeks. Four Republican state senators have said they will step down in 2020, giving Democrats hope of winning a super majority. What do you think? That's your headline. That's your story.
Yeah, and I think it's out of date at this point. I think since that story was writ, we had another Senator Rich Funke say that he was getting out of the race. There may have even been another. I mean, there's been enough at this point that I've kind of lost track. This is collateral damage. This is what happens when the Democrats, after, you know, many, many years of kind of suffering in the minority, despite living in a Democratic state, suddenly took the majority in 2018. And I think the Republicans have seen the writing on the wall. You know, I think that this has long been a state in which, there's more than 2-to-1 Democratic advantage in voter registration. I think even in Republican strongholds upstate, some of those districts have started to get more purple rather than red. And I think Republicans realize that the concept of them kind of capturing enough seats to get back into the majority in the Senate is a long-term project, to say the least, particularly going into a 2020 election cycle in which Democrats presumably will be pretty fired up to vote for Democrats with Donald Trump at the top of the ticket. Now, I will offer this caveat. If you talk to Republican strategists, they will acknowledge that they've got a problem, but they will also say that Trump is a powerful salesman and that in some of the districts in which Republicans have fared well in the past, they will continue to fare well because Trump Republicans will come out in droves to support their guy next year, too. So, in talking to Democrats, their magic number is 42, which is, it's Jackie Robinson's number. It's the meaning of life, according to Hitchhiker's Guide. But it's also the number at which you get a supermajority in the New York Senate. And the Democrats at this point are only two seats away from that. They are hoping that they can pick those seats up, either in the Hudson Valley or potentially even on Long Island, where they've made big gains, or in New York City suburbs. So if they got to 42, then you're really talking about a completely Democratic legislature with supermajorities in both chambers. And that's pretty substantial because it means they could override any veto from Governor Cuomo.
I get more letters about the gerrymander than anything else. Everybody thinks that somehow the gerrymander is the bete noire of both political parties. Up until now, the Republicans had the numbers, right, in order to insist that those districts be kept that way. When did they change that?
Well, the gerrymandering, obviously every 10 years they redraw those lines. They'll be redrawing them, I believe, in 2021, I think, after the cycle. But gerrymandering does swing both ways. Obviously, the Democrats have gerrymandered districts in certain parts of the country. But I think on par, more districts tend to be red gerrymandered than blue gerrymandered. And in New York state politics, there's certainly districts outside of cities like Rochester and Syracuse, where, you know, you had these kind of donut districts, right, where the red suburban Republicans are kind of well represented and thus get a senator. Whereas if you just kind of drew a straight line, like divided the city in half and had more Democrats from the urban areas, then potentially those districts would go blue. So, you know, no less a force than former President Obama has made gerrymandering a major part of his kind of post-presidential ambitions, as well as Eric Holder in California. You know, these are powerful Democratic figures who feel that gerrymandering has worked against Democratic interests and the Democratic Party. So I'm not surprised you get a lot of letters on that. I think it will be an issue probably even in next year's presidential campaign. You know, I wouldn't doubt it get mentioned. And it would probably be an issue of policy if the Democrats were able to kind of seize levers of power at a federal level. So
correct my naivete on this, Jesse McKinley of The New York Times. Now the Republicans have lost in the Senate. You got Democrats controlling the Senate. You've got Democrats controlling the assembly, and you have a Democratic governor. What's to prevent them from gerrymandering in their own interests?
Well, they certainly could. I mean, the question, though, is how much does the governor, who, of course, famously had suggested that he would put an end to gerrymandering with the redistricting commission when he first got elected in 2010 and then did not do that, how much political will he wants to put behind that? And you know, there has, you know, this the theory as well as I do, that Governor Cuomo very much likes to govern from the center, that certainly he gives some progressive red meat with things like same-sex marriage and minimum wage hikes, but at his heart, he's a guy that likes to be in the center, that likes to make compromises, that doesn't mind working with Republicans, and also sees some kind of progressive left-wing policies as either too expensive or too crazy or too, you know, too alienating to swaths of suburban voters and suburban donors, that he doesn't want those things to happen. So there will be some question as to how many Democrats does Governor Cuomo necessarily want to elect. You know, I had an interview a couple of weeks ago with Andrea Stewart Cousins, where she kind of, with a twinkle in her eye, was asked about this issue. And she said, well, I can't imagine the governor not wanting more Democrats. And pretty much every reporter in the room snickered because, you know, I think Democrats have been problematic for the governor, who is a Democrat, and he has certainly battled with the progressives that were elected in 2018 inside of his party, and will continue to do so. So how much he wants necessarily the state to be kind of a Democratic monopoly up, down, every part of the state, I think you'd have to ask him that question.
A great point, Jesse McKinley. Let me go following that to the fact that New York now faces a $6.1 billion budget deficit in 2020. I think that follows pretty much on the heels of what you just said. In other words, the Democrats in both the Senate and the Assembly are all for more stuff. And here's a governor who, as you say, governs from the center and who we think, at least I think, always wanted the Republicans to remain in power, even though he said not. And he'll have to deal with that huge budget. And he's not going to get an awful lot of help from those two houses.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot to unpack there. First of all, there is this kind of head scratching reality that for someone like me, who's not an economics major, and for, I think, a lot of kind of common New York voters, which is this. And we are now entering, I believe, the 11th year of economic prosperity in this nation. This has been an unprecedented economic recovery. The unemployment rate in the state is at a record low. You know, Wall Street continues to churn up and up and up. How exactly the state of New York ended up $6 billion in the hole is somewhat mystifying to, you know, dum-dums like me. I don't exactly understand the economics of this. Now, Republicans, of course, will say this is spending. And specifically, they'll say it's spending on things like healthcare and Medicaid, and as well as education spending. But wherever it is happening, it is a problem, and it is, you know, an economic hole. You know, when Cuomo came in 2010, I think he had an even bigger economic hole. And they had to fill that. Now, having said that, what is also fascinating about this is that Cuomo now has essentially a very good excuse not to do things that he doesn't want to do, which is, oh, well, we can't afford it, right? So now you've got this kind of economic bogeyman of the budget gap, the $6 billion that will simply make, you know, progressive policies such as, let's say, you know, expanding health care to everyone in the state, you know, the kind of universal health care, the New York Health Act, which has been kicking around the legislature for several sessions now, that sort of kind of broad, expensive plan will be a non-starter because the governor will be able to say, well, there's no way we can afford that. Now, the second question to that will be, how did we end up in this situation? And I think that will be a source of a lot of our reportage and reportage from other journalists this session.
Any preview on your reportage about how we ended up there?
Well, then you won't buy the newspaper.
I will. Yeah, I promise. You know, I swear I'll buy the Times.
I still got some years to retirement. I need you to keep buying the newspaper, Alan. I can't tell you what we're working on, but I can tell you that in the coming year, the economic crisis may well be used for things like marijuana legalization. You know, sure. That will be something where it provides, you know, it's, you know, what's the old saying, you know, never there's opportunity out of crisis, or never waste a crisis, or things like this. If you have a $6 billion hole, then you can use that $6 billion hole as an excuse to say, hey, let's legalize marijuana. It's going to give us $1 billion worth of tax revenue, et cetera, et cetera. Another thing would be casino expansion. You know, this was something that kind of was being kicked around, that the casino companies were really pushing for in the budget last year. They didn't quite get it over the finish line. But yet again, this is a thing where they could say, hey, you guys are a little short in the kitty this year. How about we expand casinos? How about we put a casino in New York City, where you've got, you know, 52 million tourists who might want to go throw some dice? This could easily be that sort of you know, multi-use excuse to do a lot of things to goose revenue and try to fill this hole. My final thought on this, however, will also, of course, raise the specter of taxes, which is something that Carl Hasty, in comments to reporters in the Capitol in December, said straightforwardly. He said, hey, we might need to raise taxes. Now, I think what Carl Hasty was talking about was raising taxes on the super wealthy, right? The millionaires tax and the people with, you know, yachts bobbing around in the Hudson River. Those are the people he was talking about. But that being said, even the specter of raising taxes for a guy like Governor Cuomo, who has made a point of cutting taxes, that's anathema to him. He doesn't want to do that. And the Republicans jumped all over Democrats for even raising that idea. But still, $6 billion is a big number, and they're going to have to find that money somewhere.
Implicit in your last statement about Cuomo is my belief that, you know, like his papa, he has an eye on the presidency if it breaks right for him. What do you think?
I think we've had this conversation many times, Alan, and I think that we disagree. I mean, I love the idea of Andrew Cuomo running for president because it would just be a wonderful story to write about. But I also used to be a theater reporter, and I think this is kind of Shakespearean. And I think that Governor Cuomo's father, Mario Cuomo, who was a brilliant liberal politician and had, you know, 12 years in office, thought about running for president, and then left the plane on the tarmac. And I think his son, because sons do things that fathers do, I think Andrew Cuomo has thought about being president and thought about being president and thought about being president, and probably at the end of the day, symbolically, will leave the plane on the tarmac. The only addendum I will offer to my theatrical analysis of this is that he's not an old man. He's only 62. Exactly. He could conceivably run 4 years from now if the Democrats don't win.
My point exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm trying to say.
Conceivably, my disputation of your otherwise fine analysis could be short-sighted, right? We could be talking about Cuomo 2024
exactly.
If, in fact, the Democrats can't beat Trump in 2020.
Right. And now this has been a scenario that Papa played out also, Papa Cuomo, in which people said, you don't really want McGovern or whoever it was at the time to win. You want him to lose so that you can run the next time.
I would never pretend to know the inner workings of Andrew Cuomo's mind, but I could certainly see a scenario whereby if a Democrat cannot win in 2020 and he were to then, say, either run for a fourth term in 2022 or retire after three terms and do something else for a little while, I could see him certainly, you know, at 66 years old running for president. Why not?
Okay, I only got a few minutes left here, about 12 minutes, and I want to divide this up very carefully because it's not everybody. Every day we get Jesse McKinley of the New York Times here. So first of all, on early voting, did that make a difference in New York State that you can see?
You know, I think the stats are still out. I think the early, I would have to back and look. I think it was about a little bit of a bump of a point maybe in the electorate. But keep in mind, this was 2019. This has been an off year, an off year. It's not even, it's not even a congressional, non-gubernatorial, non-presidential year. It's an odd numbered year. So I think those sorts of returns are stats kind of without a meaning. I do think that in general, when you talk to kind of people that have looked at this nationally, they do see a slight increase in voter participation, usually about a percentage point, sometimes two. But keep in mind, even in the United States, even in places that have adopted this for years and years, it's not like a generational thing. You know, people are not necessarily used to this, to coming in, 3 weeks or 4 weeks before the election day and casting their ballots. So if you talk to people that believe in this sort of system, I think they think that as people get accustomed to it, as people get used to it, as people like it, because it's more convenient, because you don't have to stand in the line on the first Tuesday in November, that you can go in on a Monday afternoon in late October, that it will get more and more successful and more used. So, I think you have to wait for it to kind of take hold and for awareness to kind of raise. But once again, I think no matter where you come down on the political spectrum, there's, you want people to vote. That's what a democracy is about. So the more opportunities that people have for it, I think that it's hard to argue against that.
Okay. In a veto message, Cuomo says he doesn't want Trump-appointed judges officiating marriages. Does that just sort of lead to the image of tough guy Andrew, taking no prisoners?
Yeah, that story this week, the New York Post caught it last week, and I think that was an odd one. I mean, I don't really, when you read the law, the law itself had zero to do with, Trump judges or Obama judges or Dwight Eisenhower judges. It was just allowing federal judges from around the United States to officiate at weddings, and Cuomo's message got very, very kind of haughty, where he was like, I cannot possibly condone this sort of behavior, leaving aside the fact that he effectively wouldn't let judges that had, in fact, been nominated and appointed by President Obama or President Clinton, both of whom were Democrats, those guys wouldn't be able to officiate weddings either. It just seemed like a strange moment to make a statement. The one funny thing that I caught when I looked at the veto statement was that he apparently felt so strongly about it, he said it twice. He was like, I veto this message. I veto this message. It was, it was almost as though he was dictating it to someone who was trying to keep up. So anyhow, I think that there's a lot of ways to get a marriage license in the state of New York, including online. So if people really want a federal judge to officiate their wedding, I'm sure that they can find a way.
Let's talk about the green light law. A lot of people checking in on this, allowing people to drive in New York who aren't credentialized as citizens or worse. Is there a resolution to that?
Well, I mean, there's no resolution in terms of it's the law now. So, the first day it was enacted, which I think was a couple of weeks ago, you saw big numbers of people that were foreign nationals who simply wanted a driver's license in the United States show up and try to get those types of identification. This was very popular, I think, in more liberal areas like New York City, particularly areas like New York City where you might have a large, foreign expat population or people here who don't have documentation from their home country or are not here legally. I think that in more far-flung places upstate where there were less less Democratic voters is, who may not support this sort of thing, it was more controversial. Certainly in Nikki Kern's area in Western New York, in Erie County, he has fought very hard against this. You know, a lot of Republican county clerks have said that they fear, you know, this sort of identification, a driver's license being used to get it on a plane and raising specters of terrorism and things like this. You know, once again, this is not just a political practical issue, you know, a driver's license, but it's also a political issue because it pits kind of the Democratic Party's kind of desire for, you know, kind of a more inclusive kind of immigrant friendly society with against a conservative thinking where we have to, you know, have strong borders and strict immigration limits. So it's not just about driver's licenses, right? It becomes this much bigger issue of immigration policy. So but by and large, it seems to have, you know, been embraced very heartily downstate and less upstate. So,
okay, Jesse McKinley of the New York Times. Here goes a question. Andrew Cuomo, I think in one of the more despicable moves he has pulled, has tried to kill, it's quite clear to me anyway, the Working Families Party. Has he succeeded?
We shall see. I mean, the mechanism by which you're talking about is raising the threshold for appearing on the ballot and increasing the number of times they have to do this. It used to be 50,000 votes every 4 years. Now it's 130,000 votes every 2 years. You know, that's just a little bit outside of what the Working Families Party generally gets. I think they got about 118,000 in 2018. So it will certainly make their life more challenging. You know, Cuomo's argument would be, well, if they really want to exist, then they'll figure out a way to find those extra 12,000 votes. But certainly it speaks to, you know, a style of Cuomo to play hardball against people that he doesn't like. And his animus against the Working Families Party, I mean, the Working Families Party's problems with Cuomo go back and are well documented. Like these two gangs do not like each other. So Cuomo seems to have used, you know, the power of this commission, or at least his appointees on that commission, to make the WFP's life a lot more difficult. And we'll see if that life continues, if they're able to hit that threshold in 2020.
So while we're on the subject of the Working Families Party, if I were a New Yorker, I'm not, I live in Massachusetts, but if I was a New Yorker, I'd vote on the Working Families Party just because of this every single time. You know, just say, take that, Andrew. Anyway, the Working Families Party issued early endorsements, four of them, of progressives in the state legislature. The WFP backed the reelection of Senator Mike Gianaris, Julia Salazar, Assemblyman Ron Kim, and Assemblywoman Wu Lai Nu. So what's that about?
The candidates that the WFP gave their nod to are, you know, solidly left-leaning candidates who they feel have held up their end of the bargain by supporting the WFP in 2019, which, of course, was a banner year for a lot of, you know, long-suffering left-wing agenda items. So, you know, Mike Gianaris being the number two Democrat in the Senate chamber, I think, was rewarded for, you know, standing up to Amazon and making that a major issue and a major headache for Governor Cuomo. And so I think the WFP wanted to kind of solidify not only their standing within for those candidates themselves, but also remind those candidates that they've got their back and they want their support going forward with these new thresholds that we were just discussing. So, and keep in mind that, you know, there will be Democratic primaries, I think, from the left in 2020, and this will be indicative of kind of a larger schism in that party between the kind of firebrand left, progressive wing, and the kind of more mainstream Joe Biden middle of the road. And I think that's going to play out on the presidential level and on the federal level, but it's also going to play out here in the state, inside the state, but certainly at federal level on congressional races. And also, as I was saying, there is going to be this kind of ongoing debate on the presidential campaign inside the Democratic Party, whether or not the Democrats want to nominate, you know, a kind of true left-wing hero like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, or go for someone like Joe Biden, kind of more middle of the road, who might appeal to moderate Democrats as well as some Republicans. We have a story that just posted on Thursday about, you know, this idea of Republicans who may not like any of the Democratic candidates, but would vote for Biden. So, you know, I think that's going to be the big debate at the federal level and in the presidential campaign. And to an extent, that schism and that fight is going to go on at a state level, too.
Jesse McKinley is the ace reporter for The New York Times and getting to be quite a regular on WAMC. And we so appreciate it, Jesse. It's very big of you to share your thinking with us. So we'll be back in touch as time goes on, and we hope that your new year goes well.
Thanks, Alan. Happy 2023.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.